So let's talk about the right view then. How would you describe it? How would you describe the right view?
Knowledge of absence of suffering that is not your knowledge, but that's just something that you create, but that's there because you want it or because you kind of created it. It's basically knowledge of how the mind is, how the body is, how the aggregates are in and of themselves, that leaves no room for greed, aversion, or delusion.
Is there any other way that you could describe it? Because that can be taken by anybody. There's nothing in the description you provided that could not be assimilated.
What do you mean assimilated?
Assimilated by somebody who is also says like, yeah, of course, I know. What the body is, what the mind is. I know the greed, aversion, delusion, but still they're not sotapanna. So is there another way to convey the right view that a putujana would not be able to relate to it so easily and appropriate it so quickly? Anyone?
Well, there's that description that goes along the lines of...
No, I mean your description.
Well, when you see for yourself what is for your harm and others' harm, and what is for your benefit and others' benefit, and well, not for others' harm. But, so see that connection between the way you live your life and the result of that, not just that's good and that's bad.
Again, that's not wrong, but same, it's on the same level, anybody with like basic amount of information can say, yeah, of course I know how my actions lead to my welfare or not. Anything more acute?
Because it's like what you were just speaking about, he knows what is a waste of time and what is not a waste of time. But then... anybody can assimilate that.
Yeah. So basically all these are descriptions of the result of the right view. And it's like, what is the right view? That somebody without a right view can't just, I'll just assimilate that because I can kind of reason my way around it. As she started, again, or what Nandika said as well, both are correct. Mm. But, as I said, even somebody without a right view can easily assimilate the same description and say, yeah, of course. Oh, thus I have a right view now, because I understand that. So it has to be something more acute in terms of describing the right view that putujana cannot assimilate because it will go over his head. So I'm asking for some examples of that.
The inability to be moved by whatever appears. Or you experience the inability to take it personally, so to say. But then again
it's a bit more it's correct. It's correct, but
whatever thing is there, and you can say it even like there's greed, there's aversion, there's delusion, there's like your or emotion or feelings or pressures. And the thing is that if whatever is a thing is seen as a thing, including a feeling or something that's like pressuring you, but if it's actually just seen for what it is, the thing is that it can't, anything that's like, that could be called greed or that could be called aversion or could be called like anger or whatever whatever creates suffering, whatever is unwholesome, whatever can make a person do bad things, whatever is none of that can be there. None of that can be there when any include any feeling or any pressure, whenever that's seen for itself, it just, there's no room for those things. But it's not because you, I think the important thing is, it's not you getting rid of it. It's not you knowing how to see a thing as a thing, knowing how to see a thing as a thing, so that there is no room for this kind of any gratuitous anxiety, any fear, absence of fear, like zero fear, basically, where there's no room for it. But not because you got rid of it or you did something to it, but just the knowledge of how it cannot be there. And it's like, not only, and the thing is, it's also not about just being able to like experience that absence of sense of freedom once, or kind of having a sense of it, but actually knowing where it came from, what led to it, what made it possible. And so not just kind of randomly being able to, I don't know, make your mind calm, or you can make your mind genuinely calm or free or have like a sense of complete freedom. But that doesn't constitute the right view. It's more, it's knowledge of how that comes about.
Can you be more specific? Because I can just now read this Eightfold Path and everything else and essays on it and say that's how it comes about. And it's factually correct.
It's correct, but that wouldn't be...
No, but I'm saying is, when you say our knowledge of how it comes about, again, it's something Putujana can relate, because he might have been studying the suttas a lot. So, yeah. Go ahead then. Give me a more specific example of how that knowledge comes about. You said it's not that you do something on account of these things. It's how you see them.
Yes.
So how you see them? How do you see them?
That's what you're asking. Describe the right view.
How do you see them? Because yes, exactly. That's already something that Putujana will have harder time assimilating quickly, because he's used to doing stuff.
Yes.
He's used to managing things. He's used to countering things. He's used to spending time in concentration so that the mind then is calm, so that then I'm not bothered and all these things. But if you say, oh, it's none of that, it's completely the opposite direction of that, it's not what you're doing, and it's certainly not that you have to do something. It's more like simply the way you see things. But now that can be mystified. And you say, oh, seeing the way things are, and it's just oneness and isness and so on. So you have to be more specific. So then how do you see things that instantaneously doesn't even free you from fear? It's simply there is no room for fear.
And that's
even if you want to be afraid, there is no room for fear to be there.
And I think fear is a
good... So how do you see it?
Fear is a specific one, like, or an anxiety, let's say. Fear, dukkha. Anxiety, dukkha. But they're the...
The way a sort
of... So it's not on the level of,
things.
Like, the describing the thing, but describing how to see it.
How it's seen. Either way.
As arisen, as manifested. But that's, again, that something you can read in the suttas.
It's like it's the right viewing.
The right viewing, yeah.
No, the right view is the right viewing.
Yeah.
So the way you see it, the way you... The right view is a way of seeing things detached.
Yeah, that's all correct. But the actual seeing of it, describe that, not what comes as a result of seeing.
And then, so...
Rightly seeing...
It's not even about, like... Because even seeing, it's like, oh, well, I'm seeing that.
I know. There has to be some word used. So I just use that because you said it. But you can use word attending, which is more correct. Mm-hmm. It's the way you attend it. You're not looking at it necessarily in that sense.
I mean, you could describe yoni so manisakara.
Yeah, of course.
Which is...
So describe then yoni so manisakara in ways relevant to fear or dukkha that you just brought up, that then a Patujana would not be able to relate to because he's used to managing his dukkha and fear. So how can you then attend an arisen thing so that there is no room for that thing to exhibit pressure or any form of dukkha on you? So describe that way of attending. So take the experience of anxiety or fear and describe to me how you would be attending to it.
Well, you know, you say attending to the situation as a whole, you know, detached from what, you know, the fear, at the same time simultaneously seeing the body there, so you're cutting up things are detached, cut apart. You know, like that simile of the butcher and the cow.
Yeah
So things are like that,
but I want it more acutely, so without resorting to you can do this or you can do that. You have the experience of frightening experience or anxiety, just in relation to that. How can you attend to it that would result in there being no room for any discomfort?
Besides saying, not myself.
Well,
besides that.
Not myself is the result of it. But it's,
once you know how to write attended, you can keep reminding yourself, but not for me, not mine, not myself, as it would encourage it. But
so,
I want it just acutely on the way of seeing it as it is right there, seeing through it. That, again, you don't have to do anything else. That's why it's liberating. That's why amidst the suffering, Sotapanna doesn't suffer.
It's the nature of...
All of that's correct. But
it's
none of that is the acute... ceasing nature, it's on the level of the insight, because you attend to it rightly. What
attending
is that
to
attending
rightly.
To it rightly? That's what I want described.
Well, in a way, not putting yourself in relation to it, or not trying to see it, or overly define it, or just... In a way, not putting things where you want them to be, or in a way you want them to be, or in a way you don't want them to be. In a way, seeing
you
them
can, you
where
can,
they
and
are.
You can only do that because so your ability to attend is second to it being there.
Mm-hmm.
Second in it, in a kind of a sitting on top of it. It's not like you're not not able to like choose to attend to it.
Mm.
It precedes the fact that you're already attending to it.
Yeah.
And it's that like kind of already there-ness,
so
that is kind of the thing that you need to attend without attending it.
Yeah.
So it's like not attending it, but recognizing it as kind of already underneath the attention.
Yeah.
And then that's it's that element basically that is impossible to appropriate or impossible to own, impossible, like even if you want, even if you turn all of your attention to it, try to make it yours, you can't because it's just, it's impossible.
It's undermined.
It's completely undermined.
And always remains undermined. Out of the reach, basically.
It's completely out of, and like, you know, even if, you know, even if you doubt it with all your might, even if nothing, it's completely inaccessible. And it's inaccessible because that's literally just how it is.
Yeah.
And it's, so it's under, exactly, like, it undermines, it's undermined already, or it undermines itself, as you put it.
Mm.
And that's, there's no room. There's just, it's impossible for there to be anxiety. It's just not, there's no basis for it. And it's not... It's not like, I'm not moved by this or whatever. There's no possibility, no basis for anxiety.
There's no possibility of being moved by it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's exactly, no, that's it. See, that cannot be appropriated so easily. And it all boils down to that, like, a person, generally everyone, is used to attending to things, and he puts that first.
Mm-hmm.
They put that first. So the fact that you're already attending to dealing with your anxiety or fear means it has arisen already. It's been enduring there underneath, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
It presented itself. You find it there through your attention. But the weight, the emphasis is on your attention. So, although it came second, so to speak, structurally, mm-hmm. not necessarily temporarily, you put that first. So your attention and dealing with it is the center of the experience, failing to understand that all of your efforts, all of your movements, all of your concerns, all of your cravings, all of your reactions, actions and counteractions and so on, are because the thing is still there enduring.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why sense restraint has to come first. So you stop acting out in those grossly outward ways. And then internally, you still might be moving and the mind still might be jumping at the prospects of dealing with it and doing this, encountering it. But through all of that, through saying yes, no, both yes and no, neither yes nor no, if you don't act out and if you are making some effort to discern what else is simultaneously there, you'll find it's the arisen thing.
Mm.
That is simultaneously there with you attending to it. And that thing comes first, not your attention. And then there is no room for anything there, nothing else. It's with this, this is. The Patitsampada principle.
Mm.
That's why whoever sees the Dhamma sees Patitsampada. Whoever sees Patitsampada sees the Dhamma. In other words, Sotapanna begins to see Patitsampada. That's why it's like, it's instantaneous. That's why it's akalika, it's timeless. Because there is no time involved between you attending to this and that thing being given.
Mm. And that's why it's not a matter of like, then it becomes timeless. As in, it's not a matter of doing some other unrelated or sort of semi-related things. More like literally just practicing. Developing that same
simultaneous recognition further and further, and preventing yourself from engaging with it in these manners that would put your attention first.
Mm-hmm.
So, by that I mean not distracting yourself, because there will still be, in Sotapanna's experience, there would still be aspects of his life that are still putting his attention first, as opposed to the experience he's attending, such as sensuality, ill will, hindrances, and so on. And that's how you purify mind from it. But he does have the principle being, how do I free myself from this hindrance or from that issue or this issue by seeing through it, not by doing this or that. That's why it's like directly visible, here and now, not involving time. For as long as there are five aggregates, there is the possibility of seeing through them correctly.
And that is, that's an important point, that, like, that's the direct, that's another way of describing the direct relationship or relevance of virtue and sense restraint, as in, because if you haven't been developing virtue, haven't been developing sense restraint, it doesn't matter what language or how much you try to wrap your head around this kind of notion, your whole mindset is just about me controlling things, me doing things.
Exactly.
Me,
being that's able why to, we say so often, enduring things on the right level.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have not, oh, he said something and he's completely wrong, and although I know I'm upset and I shouldn't say anything while I'm upset, I'll still say it because it's for greater good, it's for the benefit of everybody, I must point out the mistake. You feel externally justified, internally you acted out of pressure of ill will or irritation or whatever. Which means for as long as you're not able to endure those things rightly, internally, for as long as it takes, regardless of what kind of injustice you're looking at and so on, means you haven't endured things sufficiently enough. And that means basically you refuse, by refusing to endure it sufficiently enough, you refuse to put your attention of the issue second.
Mm-hmm.
Like even if you keep saying to yourself, I'm attending through this and I'm seeing through it and I'm not giving it priority, you do simply by acting out. By not being able to endure, that's how you actually already pivot your order. You already put your attention first as well, it should be second.
And that's also why it's impossible to build up any sense of this is another thing I was thinking about, build up any sense of conceit, for example, on the right
sure.
practice, like, because
in
people do that with any other kind
yeah.
of spiritual practice. I feel
yeah.
better, and you might be factually kind of developing some things that genuinely sort of make you more virtuous, but more able to manage things, but less suffer less than other people and so on. But
you can't be conceited about it. And even like, even if you come across as whatever, extremely confident or blunt or rude, that's not the measure of conceit. If people think that's conceited, it's because usually they themselves cannot understand behavior. They could be like that, but it's not effectively conceit, because if they were to behave that way, it would be conceited.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a kind of fallacy that they project. And it's that whole kind of understanding that's implied when you discern how to attend things rightly, in a way of not attending them. Attending that which is there without attending it. Then, no room for unwholesome. No room for vanity, for conceit, for sensuality. No room for hindrances, for that matter either. Yeah. Any other way we can describe? Attending to things without attending them? Like, how can you attend to things without attending them? Isn't there a contradiction?
But like you said, it's about where you put the emphasis.
Mm.
So recognizing that to be able to attend to something, it has to be there.
Mm. So
presented.
How can you say it differently? Has to be there. How can that be described?
Given beforehand.
Given beforehand, yeah.
I think, yeah.
So what is given beforehand has to be there.
Mm-hmm.
What do those things have in common?
Well, you don't have
like how do you
know?
They're
known, exactly.
I was
going to say, how do you know that? Because you know
you
that.
You know, and that's.
And that's not what you're doing.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually nearly a way. If you can ask, what do I know?
Yeah.
As in, what can I not help?
But know.
But know.
Yeah.
And that's actually even the meaning of the word knowledge.
Yeah.
That's literally just what it means. What's given.
Yeah,
there.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, consciousness.
Yeah, of. But conscious of, but again, like it's sort of. It's been proliferated so much that people, like, when they talk about consciousness, it's not nowhere near the consciousness. So you have to kind of find a practical basis, such as whatever, experience of fear or this or that, as we did, and then talk about attention, and then talk about, okay, but so you, the fact that you're attending it, the fact that you're dealing with it, means it's given beforehand. It was arisen there on its own. It came first, so to speak. Not before.
Mm-hmm.
It's at the same time, but it's under you, let's say it like that. And it's like, oh, but you do already know that, which is why you're choosing to attend to it in this manner or that manner, trying to get rid of it, trying to do this, trying to do that, because it's already known to that extent. Yeah, sure, you don't understand it, because if you did, you wouldn't be trying to act out of it. You would then emphasize the knowledge of it being there beforehand while it's exerting pressure on you, and refrain from acting out of that pressure, which would tip the scales back onto that perverted order. And that's kind of probably, I think, the most acutely that you could describe how to get the right view for somebody who doesn't have the right view. When faced with dukkha, big or small, doesn't matter, by not acting out of it, you discern that it's given beforehand while you're not acting out of it, for as long as it takes. Forever. You're ready to do it forever. To emphasize the discernment of what you already know at the expense of acting out of it and telling to yourself that it came there beforehand and everything else because you really want to get rid of it. And that's the subtle trap that Putujan's mind would be falling into. So this is perfectly intelligible, you can understand this, but then when you're actually under the pressure of some form of dukkha, your first emphasis is attend to it through the attitude of wanting it to go away, wanting to get rid of it. And now you do what Ajahn Mali said. All right, so it's there beforehand, given, I know that. See, none of that is actually correct now. So first and foremost is, I mustn't do anything, including what Ajahn Mali said you must do. So then, what you're left with, you get to discern as being there. And then don't act out of it. And rinse and repeat. And if you're keeping the precepts and celibate, you wouldn't need to be seeking dukkha for your practice. There will be plenty. Plenty of pressures to go around. What other way can we use to describe that? So you can know it without, well, you can attend it without attending it in the ways of you're used to. You can know it as being given beforehand, again, without attending it directly. You recognize that it's there on its own. What other ways? What other description of that relationship between you and that thing, between you and a risen Dhamma? How can we describe it? They would not involve time. They would not require doing. What are the properties?
They're on its own terms.
On its own terms?
It's...
Yeah.
Again.
What's the property of that experience as a whole? Few experiencing pressure of anxiety to act out of it. So you have the arisen phenomenon of pressure, discomfort, you're not acting out of it. So what are the characteristics of that experience, you under that pressure that has arisen on its own, and so on and so forth. What's like the main characteristics that would prevent you from putting yourself first and trying to deal with it? Even if you want to, even if your mind is still revolving around those thoughts, rightly established attitude of what would disable any effectiveness of the mental tendencies to put yourself first and deal with the discomfort or engage with comfort, if viewed rightly. What would be the most impersonal characteristic of the right viewing?
Well, that's what I've come with, that it's impersonal.
Yeah, but what makes it impersonal? What makes it impermanent?
Hold on.
You're drifting away now, we're just listing things.
Yeah, but
so, we're talking about your experience being under the pressure of a recent phenomenon. So it's like me dealing with this or not dealing with this, attending it or not, both, neither. What do I do? Move left, right, up, down, away, indulge, give up. So there is that relationship between you and that thing. So what is the main core characteristic of that relationship that is why thing is impermanent, that is why the thing is unknowable, that is why if you're viewing it through that characteristic of that relationship, you would be unable to put yourself first.
So you're talking about this relate, like as in you there's you and this.
Yeah, there is you and there is the pressure. Yeah, that's why you put yourself first and what you want first.
Kind of, yeah. So you're talking about how to then.
I'm talking about right viewing of that relationship.
Of that relationship, so that it.
What is its core characteristic of that right viewing?
I would say kind of being complete in and of itself, as in there's having no.
Yeah, go on.
In, like that's the entirety of it.
It's the entirety of it. Yeah.
That there isn't.
So when you have two things that are complete to each other extent. How do they relate? What is their relationship then? How would you call it?
Well, simultaneous.
Exactly.
Simultaneous, yeah, okay.
And that's the point. Mm. The simultaneity of it. See, even if somebody without a right view were to start training simultaneously, knowing what they're attending while they're attending it, it would bring them closer to the knowledge of that thing without needing to attend to it directly. Because simultaneity of you and that thing is not something you can do. Doesn't matter how much you emphasize your attending and your dealing and your movement and your reaction or whatever else, it remains unchanged. It's all within that. So with this is. And for as long that remains unchanging, that simultaneously is there. And then you realize once you recognize that simultaneity, that's why you cannot own things, because your ownership comes second to it. It's just one of the things, one of the two things that are simultaneously dependent on each other to the extent that they are. Or trying to own, or trying to possess, or trying to control, or acting upon, putting yourself first in regard to things that are simultaneously present, it's the reason for your dukkha. That's why they are impermanent, because they are otherwise.
Yeah, and that's also because if you see that that's simultaneous and the dependency of it, that you can't have the sense of, like, if it's the sense of me, for example, and this other thing.
No, you have.
As in, you have that. You start with that.
Yeah.
But you see them as simultaneously dependent. As in, they can, like, it's literally kind of, that's what I meant
when
by
there
complete.
I know, that's why I said go on. Carry on, because that brings you closer to the point. When there are two, and there is no other option there, neither can be the one.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's the point. And that's why you do start with your sense of self. You don't deny it. But by seeing it simultaneously dependent on something else that's not your sense of self, mm-hmm. right there, to the same extent, it will cease to be yours. Mm-hmm. It will still remain. Mm-hmm. Namarupa, vijnana, vijnana, namarupa, dependence from Patitsampara still remains in the Narahant. Mm-hmm. What does not remain there is the ownership of either or both and so on. So, exactly, on the level of the experience as a whole, not like me and this chair or something. Although, if you're viewing it rightly, it can be anything. But in the beginning, you need to start seeing it on the level of your experience as a whole. Like your totality of your experience here and now, seated in this room, sense of I am, with, and then wherever your attention lands, whether it's a particular feeling or a thought or a memory or a pleasure or pain, doesn't matter. Anything that you are relating to, there and then to that extent. And if you start seeing it as simultaneously enduring, as opposed to me dealing with this, then me dealing with that. No, it's me dealing with this while both are there to the same extent. Oh, a new me dealing with this, with something new, to the same extent. Then a new me dealing with something new to the same extent. Because that's what it really is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's the recognition of that simultaneity that can bring you the closest to the right view. And it's not something you can do. You cannot possibly lay out a method of step-by-step method of do 1, 2, 3 and then you see the simultaneity. And that is pretty much the core of the beginning that remains unchanged from the start till the end, till the completion of the practice.
Uh-huh.
So the point is,
I'll get rid of.
Yeah. So the point is, like,
do with this. This is.
Yeah. Exactly. Because the actual principle of Patitsampada, regardless of its formulation in the suttas, always starts with this. This is. Mm-hmm. It must mean sati inahoti. That's it. Every single time. Then it can sometimes be 8 factors, or 12 factors, or 16 factors, and so on. But you realize the principle remains unchanged. So you can't have the exemplification of the principle contradicting the principle, because then it's not the exemplification of the principle. So if the principle is with this, this is, then the exemplification of it has to be within that principle. It's just basic logic. But again, given the whole commentarial tradition and Abhidhamma and the whole amount of proliferated misleading information created on top of it, now when people hear dependent origination, they have those wheel of life tankas and stuff in their mind of how, you know, from rebirth process and stuff like that, fully ignoring or being completely unaware of the principle. So put the whole dependent origination aside as a formulation. Yeah. And just talk about yoniso manasikara. Which is already the principle of Patitsamuppada when seen rightly. And somebody who develops yoniso manasikara learns how to attend to things simultaneously without attending to them directly, will then see how Patitsamuppada formulation describes that very thing. But it's highly likely you would arrive at that thing through studying Patitsamuppada formulation today, because of everything that happened in between with commentarial and studies and everything else, piles and piles and piles of pretty much misleading directions.
There's that other sutta that says, where the Buddha gives us that basic description, do you see this?
Exactly. Mm. Yeah, imagine Mika.
Do you see this as its condition?
Yeah.
You know,
and then he asks the monks, the one who attends like this, can he doubt that? He says, no, impossible. The one who doesn't attend to it like this, can doubt arise? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's like the most...
It's as acute as it gets.
Do you see this? Do you see this as its condition?
Yeah.
And do you see the cessation of this condition?
Yeah. If this is not, would this be?
Yeah. Yeah.
The two.
Is there uncertainty? Is there uncertainty when there's doubt in regard to this?
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's kind of a.
So take your sense of self, however you might be feeling, in its entirety, here and now, and then discern, without abandoning, without attending something else, discern within that acute, concrete, living sense of self that you are, discern that something in its core that self depends upon, that it's not in your control. So, bring that thing up to be simultaneously there as an undermining condition for your sense of self. And then let it endure, and the mind will turn away from it, and then you repeat it, and then you repeat it, and then you repeat it.
And those same things, that's why...
And you should be feeling it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's like it's not just on the level of like, okay. If you get your sense of self feeling this or that right here, right now, and while that's present, discern something in its heart that undermines it, yet it's not in your control, cannot be possessed without abandoning this sense of self here and now. You possess it when you make it a new thing, when you attend to it, becomes your sense of self. But now you've fallen from that simultaneous recognition. So you're just moving from one to the other, from one to the other, maintaining your sense of ownership, because you're not undermining things through that simultaneity. So that's why it's important to recognize yourself and not just attend to what under... Oh, that's anicca, that's anicca, that's anicca. No. Take your sense of self, however it feels, with its safety, with its ownership, with its implications, and without thinking about something else, discern, even if it's a vague thing, that there must be something simultaneously present that actually your entirety of this experience of sense of self depends upon, yet that thing cannot be yours at the same time. It can be yours after, but then something else won't be yours at the same time. So you're always undermined. Wherever your attention rests, something else will undermine it.
But you could start, with just what makes you deeply anxious.
Mm.
This sort of deep existential anxiety that everybody experiences. Mm. And see what is at the what is that on the basis of? That
you would have to start with the existential anxiety. Mm-hmm. And then first you would have to not put yourself first as somebody is trying to get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
So first there's existential anxiety, okay, now let me not try to get rid of it.
Mm-hmm. So see.
So the existential anxiety is there, the sense of self is there.
Yeah.
Let it endure.
And then...
Keep it, maintain it, simultaneously recognized.
And so then that's why I think you could say the same contemplations that would, without the right view, be the source of the deepest fear or anxiety would become the most pleasant thing to think about, really.
It would bring you the closest to the right view.
Because it is the measure then of liberation. There was actually that other sutta. It's something similar to that. I think it maybe said, it would not be, if it were not, it would not be for me, it will not be, and it will not be
it
mine.
It won't be mine.
And so he says, this is terrifying to an ordinary person.
Yeah.
And to an Arahant or somebody where the liberation is.
And it's terrifying, not because it's genuinely terrifying in itself. The cessation is not terrifying. Yeah. It's terrifying only if you still are unknowingly putting yourself first, which means your sense of ownership and control is there maintained. And that's why this is the utmost contradiction to it, challenge to it, and that's why it's the most frightening one. So if you have that, most people wouldn't be able to hold it at the same time without losing perspective, without being overwhelmed by the fear or anxiety, if it's on that level. But you can work up to it, and you work up to it with what I just described. So you start by recognizing, I'm here, to this extent, such and such, my sense of self, sense of I am, real as such, no issue with it. And with that experience as a whole, within that experience as a whole, without, again, trying to attend to a new thing or fall into like a linear psychological explanation, discern, well, even just take your body present here, your beating heart, even the arisen feeling for that matter, that pretty much defines your sense of self there and then. You realize you have no say in its simultaneous presence there. You have no say in the simultaneous presence of the beating heart here, yet my whole life depends on it. This whole sense of self depends on this, I mean, living heart right here, as I'm thinking this. If that changes, the slightest obstruction or something, none of this can remain. What do you do next? Repeat it. And if you haven't forgotten it, if you haven't overly attended to it and made it into a new thing, then just let it endure there. And obviously you're going to feel it. And that's the measure. When you're right attending, kind of first makes you feel things more, but then makes you unfeel them. Same thing. You're not doing anything extra. Just through repeatedly attending them, the feelings were increasing, the fear, the pressure. You didn't back down. You kept repeatedly attending to it rightly, concurrently, yoni sumanasikara of it, indirectly, whichever way you want to translate it. And now, those feelings are being unfelt, while nothing has changed. Well, what is changing is the shift of the emphasis from over here, me, I am, onto not mine, not I am, over there. It still remains. That which was self remains. It's just not yours anymore.